Welcome to Leadership for Tomorrow, starting now, the podcast designed to inspire and empower leaders to act today for a better tomorrow.
Whether you are just starting out or aiming to level up, we are here to help you grow, connect, and make an impact.
Join us for engaging stories, practical tips, and endless inspiration to fuel your leadership journey.
Discover how you can make a difference, starting right now.
My name is Hugo Santos. I'm an assistant lecturer here at the University of Wyoming in Casper. And here's my co-host.
Hello, Rochelle Green. I'm the director for our organizational leadership program at UW Casper.
And today we have a really special guest with us. Today we have Carrie Reese. So Carrie Reese has been an executive director at the Seton House since 2020, where her compassionate leadership has transformed the organization into a beacon of hope for single parents' families facing homelessness. With a bachelor's degree in English literature and creative writing from the University of Puget Sound, Carrie brings a unique blend of empathy and insight to her role. Under her guidance, the Seton House combines practical support with a nurturing environment, fostering a community that empowers parents with the resources and resilience needed to build their lives.
Thank you, Carrie, for coming. It's wonderful having you.
Ask you about the kind of community you serve, because you said a lot about families, single parents, right? Does it include men and women, right, with kids? So do you have like age restriction for the kids?
So Seton House serves single parent families with minor children. And there isn't an age limit on parents specifically. And we do have occasionally some grandparents who will come into our program because they are the legal guardian of minor children. We have served an older sibling who has custody of a younger sibling because of the death of parents or incarceration of parents. So there's a little bit of wiggle room there. We serve predominantly single mothers. We do serve single fathers, and I haven't been able to nail down a meeting where that decision was made, but I do think it was about 12 years ago. The board at that time decided, let's add some single dads to the picture. And at the most, we've had five dads at the same time, and that was kind of mind-blowing for all of us. Right now, we have one gentleman, and he is a sibling, so we don't have any single dads. Out of about 50 people in 1 year, maybe five will be dads. But I always tell people, in the cycle of addiction, you know, drugs don't choose a man versus a woman. And so many of the single dads we have served have had a co-parent. The mom is in the cycle of addiction or is incarcerated because of the cycle of addiction. And so, of course, we would serve dad. Dad has care of the children. We do not serve parents with no minor children. So if you have, say, a 20-year-old son and you want to apply to our program, we want to help you find what's next for your 20-year-old son. And some of this is generational. You know, you think about three generations ago, you know, people leaving home at 14. And then now you think this generation, you know, we have a lot of folks in their 20s who will remain with their parents. And that's cultural. I mean, you know, you can think about a lot of other world cultures where the kids don't move out, where multi-generation in one family. And we're not trying to tell people how to live their lives. But as far as conserving and utilizing resources, if you are an adult, if you wanted to live in our program, I would have to have a separate legal agreement with you. Otherwise, really, insurance doesn't work and liability doesn't work. The exceptions I would make are going to be those adults where mom or dad has some younger siblings and the adult child is possibly not looking to live at Seton House but is maybe engaged in college and is going to need somewhere to be for Christmas break, is going to need to be somewhere when the dorms are closed. The other one would be when that adult child, and again, we're talking about somebody that's like age 18 through about 21, when that person maybe has a pretty significant developmental disability. So if mom is raising children and she has an older child that is autistic or is developmentally dis- uh, uh, has a developmental disability, we would really look at that as an exception. It's tricky because, of course, the adult really does need to be contributing financially. A single mom who is experiencing homelessness and trying to get on her feet, we need to make sure she's utilizing the resources that are available for that adult that's in her household. And if that means, you know, disability or Social Security disability is what I'm referring to, but also just other supportive resources that, you know, are available in this community. So we don't have a lot of that. It's mostly minor children.
I think that's such an amazing support. Like when I was reading about like the Seddon House and learning more about it, I went to Rochelle's office and say, that's amazing. That's so cool. And like, I love that kind of support that you give, that you guys bring to the community, and really empowers them. I think that makes a lot of difference.
It's evolved really significantly from the beginning. The original intention of Seton House, the gentleman who founded it in the 80s, he was trying to provide emergency housing and shelter for single moms in his neighborhood that were trying to leave those cycles. And he was offering 30 days. And I don't know all of the milestones and the timeline very specifically. Like, I don't have that memorized. But what we know now, and imagine that we didn't have meth on the streets in the middle of the 1980s. And so then fast forward all these years, and the need has changed pretty significantly. But also just the world of sociological research, can I say that? The world of research in the area of sociology has you know, just, it's so dramatically more, better. There's so much, we know better, so we do better. And the idea of a self-sufficiency program instead of just a place to find shelter is, we feel, so much more valuable and effective. And it's just a better use of resources, because we do have an excellent homeless shelter here. And if you are just homeless and you aren't interested in, you know, making any changes or making a commitment to a program, then that's a great place to go. Ours is, it's a commitment. I mean, we're asking you to do a lot of hard work.
That's amazing. Yeah, I've seen that even with students, you know, younger students, that it takes longer than an emergent time frame. Yeah. Like it usually can take several months to a year, even working with, to try to break some sort of a cycle. So could you share a story or an example that highlights some of the impact that you've seen at the Seton House?
Ooh, there's
could be a family.
Yeah, there are a lot of really great stories. I do make a point at every board meeting to share a very specific story about a family. So 12 times a year, my board hears about a specific family and how I feel like they're just killing it. And sometimes they don't last, sometimes they do last. But when I asked Amalia, she suggested a young woman who came to us. And honestly, I feel terrible, but does she have 7 children? I think she has 7. And I think only 5 came with her. And I'm not even sure how long she lived with us, but she was being coached by one of our colleagues. And I do know that when she left us, she moved into her own lease on a home, and she had a management position in her job, which included some paid time off, definitely paid sick and paid vacation. And I guess I feel like she learned a ton of parenting strategies from her coach. And so we were feeling really successful. Of course, we didn't really want to let her go. We wanted her to stay longer and gain more stability, but she was ready to go. And sometimes this involves romantic relationships, because we don't really, you know, no guests, no overnight guests. And so it's difficult probably to carry on a romantic relationship when you're living in our program, which is okay. That's by design. But she came back in. I think she's come in before, but 2 times. But she came in a couple of weeks ago, and she was just at a critical all-time low. She was really experiencing a mental health challenge that pretty much quickly turned into a mental health crisis. And my level of training through just mental health first aid was, we're not leaving this room without a safety plan. And we're probably not leaving this room without outside assistance, whether we're going to call non-emergent or whether we're going to help you get to a facility that can help you support your mental health, because she was really at a breaking point. And it was really stressful. And I did follow her in my vehicle, because we don't transport people, but I followed her to a local facility where she, and I walked in with her, where she, I knew she could engage in some mental health support. And oh my gosh, I walked back out to my car, and I didn't know whether I should cry or just like take a nap. I didn't, you know, I was really emotionally exhausted, but I was also so thankful to have had enough training, and for my colleague to have had enough training to support me. We didn't do anything alone. We absolutely grab a colleague. Everything in pairs for our own safety, but also just the liability of if I say the wrong thing now, the stakes are higher. And I returned to the office, and my colleague was waiting, and I went into her office and sat down and, you know, did some deep breathing and then just said, oh, my God, I'm so glad we were here today. I'm so glad our door was open today. I'm so glad she knew that this was a safe place to walk back in the door. And I do, one of my second mantras is that door will always be open. You will always be welcome here. I tell people the only way that you're not welcome here is really if you threaten my life. And we're at like 2 out of like 300 people in 4 years that really I would actually be genuinely frightened if they walked in the door. But otherwise, even if you are angry and you have said all the ugly, dirty things to me, I'm going to just call that a bad day, and you're still welcome to walk in our office. And so this woman, who, by the way, did not say anything ugly when she left, she knew we were a safe place. She knew that Seton House was going to, somebody on our team was going to stop what they were doing and take some time to talk with her and help her get to the bottom of it. And, you know, we provided some tangible resources, and then we called and made that referral, and then we followed through. I would have put her in a cab, but she really, really wanted to have her vehicle there, which I respect. So we gave her enough freedom to still make her own choices about getting herself there. But we also narrowed it down to, you can go get some help, or we're going to utilize some law enforcement to make sure that you get some help, because what I'm not going to do is send you home at this level of an all-time low. So that's not a fun success story. Holy cow, let's come up with a better fun success story.
I feel like it is a success story, because you've given that, empowered that individual to feel safe enough. And even when you're talking about self-preservation, that they felt confident enough, even in an all-time low, to come back. So I would say that's a success.
You build that trust, right? Which is so powerful. Like, I think I totally agree.
And interestingly, as the director of the organization, I'm not the person building their relationships. I do their intake, because I'm coming from a property management standpoint at that initial intake. So I'm in that interview about vetting, and then they see me again the day that they're moving in, and we sign some legal documents together. And I do spend, ask Amalia, 2 full hours with them, really discussing, walking them to the apartment, making sure the door code works, looking through, you know, anything in the apartment that needs to be repaired or replaced that's not going to work. But it's their coach with whom they build the relationship. And I do think the fact that this woman walked in and who she needed was unavailable, but she was like, you'll do. And I thought, well, thank you. I'm glad I'll do, because I'm going to give it everything I've got. But we do have some really brilliant success stories of young families who needed a hand up and got on their feet, and then they circle back around and drop off resources. They circle back around and bring someone in. Hey, this is my friend Jenny. You know, I just told her that this might be a really great program for her because she needs some help getting on her feet, and right now she's just not doing that well. And then, you know, we go off and meet with Jenny, and she does an application. And we have some families. We have one that moved out last spring, and she had just finished an EMT training here at the college and moved into her own apartment. She's doing great. Well, she comes back weekly to get food support because she likes that there's somebody to touch base with. And she calls and says, are you in the office? And I say, yeah, come on by. And if I'm not, she's like, I'll come tomorrow. And so then I know it isn't just the food that she wants, like, you know, to have a little cheerleading. She wants to have a little friendly. And she's got a baby that was born while she was living at Seton House, and that little one is 2. She learned my name last week. She said hi, and I said, do you know my name? And she just gave me the deer in the headlights. So I told her, and she said, and you know, in her voice with no R's, she said my name. And so some of the really positives are when somebody leaves but they feel safe and welcome to come back for resources, or just safe and welcome to come back and show us their successes. That's when I love to just have somebody, hey, did you know I, you know, accomplished this or I accomplished that? I told you I would, and I wanted you to know that I did. We tell people, like, we want to be your village, we want to be your big cheerleaders, but we're also going to hold your feet to the fire. We're going to hold you accountable. But when they want to come back and tell us, then we feel successful, because our big goal is that the people we're serving will become our colleagues and our neighbors. And so I wish I had a better, really specific, tangible story.
I know how my heart feels, Carrie, in 10 minutes of hearing these stories. So I can imagine you've been there for 4 years. So how do you take care of yourself and your staff to make sure? Because I just know, like I said, after 10 minutes, how I feel. Yeah. So I can imagine going through that day after day. Like, how do you make sure that you're able to come back every day and be that strong person for them?
It has taken a long time to build the right team. And I think people, that's universal. You, almost every workplace you go into, I mean, you might have gotten lucky and you just walked into a workplace that just had brilliant people doing a brilliant job. But it's taken a long time to build the right staff, a staff that cares a lot about each other. I don't need my staff members to be besties outside of work, but I need them to be able to read each other. And we have a lot of systems in place. We've written so much policy in 4 years. Policy related to nobody goes to an apartment alone. It's always in pairs. When we don't have enough staff, we keep that front door locked so that we don't have street traffic that are going to throw us for a loop. Just real safety issues on that. And then interestingly, you can imagine stair-stepping from I care about your safety and I care about your well-being to then they care about my safety and my well-being. And then we hold each other accountable. So if Carrie's trying to stay late to finish a grant or do a deposit, then, you know, a staff member is saying, why don't I stay with you? And if I know they're really far over on hours, I say, why don't I go home? That's the healthier balance here. Why don't we pick this up in the morning? You know, worst case scenario, maybe I'll take it home and do something at home. But when I started, I can tell you zero boundaries. I put in 80 hours a week. I probably loved every second of it because I wanted that organization to be a success and I was going to kill myself getting there. So then fast forward to loads and loads of professional development. I believe professional development is like the superhero that defeats, you know, like self-loathing and poorly prepared or poor preparation and total burnout. And so, you know, offering tangible professional development that my staff can put on their resumes so that if they decide they hate me and they want to move on or I get hit by a bus and I get replaced by somebody that's grouchy, they can move on. I think that's really valuable. You're adding value to their life. But you're adding value to the organization through the professional development. And then just insisting on some real strict self-care-based boundaries. So nobody's working overtime, period. Don't even try. And nobody's allowed to bring any of their own personal assets or resources into the resources that are being provided for our clients. So I might have the exact right size of coat for a client, and I don't wear it that much. But unless I'm planning to drop it off at Rescue Treasures or Goodwill, it's not coming to Seton House for her because that's just, it's not, you know, that I think over time is how you begin developing like, I poured so much into this and what am I really getting out of it? For me personally, the boundary of go home, stop working, go home, or don't answer your phone, that can wait until tomorrow morning, has been huge for me. All the basics, you know, making sure I have a work-life balance, making sure I get exercise, making sure I eat healthy. My staff eats lunch together every day, which is super weird, but it's a paid lunch. So we work from 8 to 4, and then we go home. And that lunch hour, we're answering the phone in the door, and we do try to take turns. If I see that Amalia's got a plate full of food, I get up and go check the door. But we don't want our population to go unserved over the lunch hour, because that is a time, especially if you're working a certain kind of job, that your boss just said, you've got 30 minutes if you want to go turn in an application or you want to go whatever you need to do. So we want to be able to serve our population, but then I can turn that into a win-win because then my staff is done at 4, and that can be more family-friendly. You know, I do some pretty loose policies about things like if someone has a sick kid, and the sick kid is, you know, probably a little too sick to be at school, maybe runny nose and cough, maybe even fever, and you want your kid in your office, as long as your kid's not interfering with our work productivity and is not actually like super contagious, then I'm okay with that. I think having some of those family-friendly policies is a big deal. I force all of my staff to take their vacation or lose it because they won't do it. I mean, not all of them. Some of them are very healthy with taking their vacation, but some of them aren't. You know, people, I read an article that it's a billion-dollar loss in the United States, the amount of unused paid vacation. And so I have a lot of those things in place to make sure that my staff is really well taken care of. We do some other smaller sort of details, like we get a huge donation from 4-H of beef and pork. So I make sure my staff has access to that completely for free as part of their salary package. We do a food bank partnership, and it's rescue, and also staff just as welcome as all of our participants to utilize that because groceries are really expensive and nobody's getting rich in a nonprofit organization. And so as part of their salary package, that food support is in there. I'm not sure I'm talking about myself very much. I might just be talking about you guys, but
I heard a lot of self, a lot of team. Uh-huh. So you're like worried about your team too.
Yeah. We also participate in specific mental health counseling that's paid for by the organization, and staff are welcome to leave the office, clock out, go to therapy, come back. That's paid time. I shouldn't say clock out. They remain clocked in. Mm-hmm. That's paid time for the mental health support. I really do believe in mental health therapy specifically. I think if you are only talking to your colleagues and your friends about the drama at work, our work is too much drama, and that's not healthy.
Where do you see the Seton House in the next 5 years?
Oh, okay.
And what role do you hope it will play in the community?
Good question. Seton House has been around for 35 years. And in that 35 years, we've built what I would actually end up calling like a real estate portfolio. We own 9 buildings in North Casper in a small like 3-block area. And one of the spaces is an empty lot, which is hot commodity. We also own 2 very small single family houses. One is in use by a family. One is not technically condemned, but there were just a lot of problems with it. And so we've ended up just using it for storage for furniture. We own a modular building at one edge of the property, and we own a 2-story, very new 8-plex apartment building. And I look at this and I talk about it and I think about it, and I spend a lot of time looking at roofs and gutters and plumbing and HVAC and how new versus how old certain things are. And so I do have a lot of opinions about the future and what I hope the organization can build. We're engaged in a strategic planning process right now. And so actually we're 1 month, like T-minus 1 month from sitting down as an entire board and organization. We've done a lot of legwork with the contract that we're using to survey previous participants, survey previous board members, survey current staff members, et cetera, to try to come together with what is really going to be our 5-year plan. And the great news is that none of it's my idea. So that's my favorite thing about the strategic plan. My really big hope would be 2 things. One, that we would be able to utilize that empty lot to build a new facility to replace some of the oldest stuff. And if that doesn't happen, I'm not going to cry myself to sleep, because if we just simply need to expand, that's okay too. But I would like very much for the future of Seton House to have 1 additional component. And I've done a little bit of traveling and a little bit of investigating to try to learn how I could shape it. But there is a gap in service, and the gap is for the single parent who doesn't have care or custody of her children but would like to start somewhere with rebuilding her life or his life. And our policy is that we want you to have your kids 50% of the time. If you don't have them right now, that's okay, but we need you to have them 50% of the time within 90 days. So when people apply to our program, we suggest that they engage in a different program, such as living at the Rescue Mission or living in the Salvation Army program, or at the Transitions Program at the Life Steps campus, which is run by the Housing Authority, until you are about 3 months from that trial in-home placement. So sometimes a mom can't be successful in one of those other environments for all sorts of reasons. And I have this vision that if we turned a building, and this would involve some physical remodel, but if we had a function where we had a space for those moms to live even for up to 3 to 6 months while they're just covering those stabilization and addressing mental health concerns, maybe even just getting 6 months of clean and sober under their belt so that some people in their family and in their circle will begin to trust them again. And they need support. They need the hand up that we want to give them, but they don't have their kids with them. And they're not going to get them back if somebody doesn't take an interest in helping them with those first few steps. So those people are being turned away from our program, and that's really painful for me because I see it as a gap in service in the Casper community, and I've definitely talked about it with a lot of other people in the community. It would require a separate program for us. It would require a separate set of expectations. We would need a physical space. There's sort of the pros and cons of would we hire a staff member to physically live there, as almost like you could envision a house mom type of situation, and then we would really only be able to serve women, and we wouldn't be able to provide that for men. But there are a couple of similar ideas out there for men right now. Some sober living things through the mission. I'm thinking the Hope House maybe is the function I'm describing. So that would be my big hope. Obviously, my other half would just be that we continue to have a really vibrant, healthy staff. The more talented people that we keep working in this organization, the stronger the future will be for the organization. And to be honest, what that boils down to is making sure that we can stay competitive with wages and benefits. And that's really tough in a nonprofit in Casper, Wyoming. we know exactly who pays what because it's all transparent on a 990. And once I started to look into that, I thought, oh, I see here where we are lacking. And so through a lot of grant funding, we've been able to become competitive with wages. And, you know, you can't hire a staff and then say, hey, you're going to go broke working here. But it'll be fun because it won't be. It's really hard work for the staff.
No, I bet. And I appreciate that because I do believe that in order to help others, you have to take care of yourself first, right?
Absolutely.
So you can offer the best. You cannot give what you don't have, right? And I think that having putting your team, well-being, safety, is it important?
We say you can't pour from an empty cup.
Yes.
And there are a lot of ways to fill up the cup. I don't need my clients to fill up my cup. I need my colleagues to fill up my cup. But I do also get real specific, and you heard me say this in the training last week, that I specifically say to every client, it's really important to me that you don't abuse the staff here because their job is to serve you and they cannot do their jobs if they are empty and if you have said unkind and unfriendly things. Circle back. Everybody gets to have a bad day, but you've got to circle back because nobody wants to come to work here if the clients that we're serving verbally abuse us. And it resonates. I have so many clients who circle back and say, hey, I'm sorry I was rude yesterday. I was really upset about this, this, or this. And I just say, oh my gosh, everybody has a bad day. Just please apologize to that person. And I got really lucky. About 2 weeks ago, I had somebody say something pretty lousy to one of my coaches. And she was hurt. I didn't realize how hurt she was. And we were in a sitting in a room. And I looked over and the coach on our team had tears in her eyes. And I thought, oh, I did not realize this is where this went. And the client was sitting, to my left, the employee to my right, and the client volunteered the apology. And I was so relieved because I thought, even if she doesn't mean it, she needed to hear it. And then we make a change and we do that thing. We tap out and have another staff member take over that client so that nobody is going home at night and feeling angry about where they work.
So you shared something, Carrie, that really stuck with me about self-preservation. And so what are some strategies, ways that you have found that you make that successful with people? Like, how do you help them?
I don't want to oversimplify, but I have definitely developed some theories, and I'm borrowing from lots of other people, so this isn't some original work that I, concluded. But for people to break any of those three cycles, there are some philosophies out there, multi-generational. So Ruby Payne really does the three-generational model. The Connection to Success program that we license, and it, just for transparency, I didn't choose it. I didn't know anything about it. I took the job. They had already engaged in a contract and paid for it and decided we're hanging our hat on this program. And when I did the training myself, of course, I was like, oh my gosh, I drank the Kool-Aid. Like, this is amazing. But some of their philosophies have to do with changing your decision-making methodology. And when you think about, and I don't mean to insult anybody, but when you think about a child, so my lived experience is parenting. And when my kid keeps making the same choice over and over again with the same results, you've got lots of theory based on that. But then when my kid, so he's getting the results of those choices, and he's saying things like, well, I don't have a choice. And then you start thinking, yeah, you do. I just gave you two choices. Well, he doesn't like either one of those choices. So he claims he doesn't have a choice. So in the Connections program, in their philosophy, the idea is that there's no good or bad choices and that they're just choices and you just get results of those choices. And if you don't like the results, make a different choice next time. And next time could be right now, like 1.5 seconds later. You said something I didn't like, so I slapped you. And then you attacked me over the table. So right now, instead, I'm going to make a whole new choice real quick, which is, oh my God, I'm so sorry. But they can extrapolate some of those, quote, not good or not bad choices. So if you decide you wanted to sell drugs, that's just a choice. You might make a lot of money. And then I think the training says, and you could put your mom in a really sweet nursing home and pay for your kids' braces with that money that you made dealing drugs. But another result of that might be that you have to live in fear and carry a gun and get a bodyguard. And another choice might be that you end up in prison and then your mom's in that really nice nursing home, but nobody's paying the bill. So she's leaving and your kid's getting his braces off because nobody's paying the bill. So it takes the drama out of it. And then I am not in the room when they're doing the training for the Connections class. And so I don't know all of the activities and exercises, but they're hoping that the people taking the class are arriving at the conclusions on their own. So instead of teaching someone and telling them how to do it, you are explaining how if you do it this way, this might happen. If you do it that way, that might happen. And you begin to help people buy into their own like self-determination. So that's the big philosophy. And what I've discovered, because I'm not in the room, I'm not teaching the class, I'm not engaged in that part of the coaching of the people that we're serving, the part that I'm engaged in is some of the vetting of people who come into our program. So we only have 22 spaces in the program. We only have 22 apartments. There was a time that there were 30, and one of the oldest buildings became, you know, untenable. And so they demolished the building and we lost 8 apartments. We made some arrangements to contract a different set of apartments, but they were a few blocks away and it wasn't a great deal. It just didn't work out. So we let that go and we're just at 22. We own an empty lot, and so, you know, there's always a different future for us. I have no idea. We might build a fantastic new building and serve more, but we might build a fantastic new building and get rid of some of our older buildings. I do think that, you know, the bandwidth of the staff right now at 22, like, we are very busy. We are all day, every day, and sometimes evenings and weekends responding to people's needs and fears and minor emergencies. I hope not major emergencies too often. But the part that I'm involved in is the fourth step in our vetting or interviewing. And so I'm in a room. It's almost never one-on-one. In fact, it's very rarely one-on-one. But it'll be me with some of my staff, and we are talking with someone, and we are looking for a person who, even if they are still mired in some kind of victim mentality or kind of mired in I have no choices, like my littlest child would say, we're looking for people who are ready to take some accountability. People who maybe even at 1 out of 3 aren't blaming someone else for where they are right now. Even looking for positive attitudes like, I know I can make a change. I know I can do something different. I know there's something better for me. And when we that's what we're hitting on. And in a group after that interview, then we're talking with each other as a staff, like, so did you hear her say this? Did you hear her say that? And we pretty much, I mean, I can look around the room and look at the faces of my colleagues and know whether they're going to give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And so for me, the evolution is stop giving everyone the thumbs up and give the thumbs up into the program for the people that have just those little elements that they're open to new decision-making methodology. Because those people are going to change their lives for themselves. We're not changing their lives. We're not making any decisions for them at all, except that if you want to enter this program, you're agreeing to these expectations. And plenty of people say, yeah, yeah, I'll do it, and they move in and it doesn't work out because they're not really agreeing to those expectations. They're just looking for somewhere else to land. And that's understandable. We have a lot of agencies in our community that are pushing people who are justice involved or who have a new DFS case, like, hey, you could go to Seton House. But if they don't actually want to engage in making real change for themselves, we're not going to convince them. There's nothing about my program, my staff, or me that are going to convince people to change their lives. That literally just has to come from within.
And I think that's so much more powerful when it comes from within, right? Like, instead of, why are you doing this? Oh, because they told me to, or because I had no choice. No, like, it's doing because I like it, I want it. That's like ownership of that, I think, so important, right? And I really appreciate you bringing that into, like, also acknowledging the dignity. Thank you. Yeah. Over like every individual, because it is hard, right? Like,
it is.
I came from this place. Like, I don't want to be judged. I want to improve. And I think it's like, personally, I have like a lot of people that came from situations like that. So I understand.
And my poker face is my greatest asset. I came with none. I have learned one. It's not brilliant, but you know, my face gives it away. And so I have to just like work on that because, you know, you cannot, in my opinion, a human being cannot degrade another human being with a facial expression that says, like, I think you're not valuable, or I think you're full of baloney, or whatever. And when I fail, and one of my colleagues across the room is drawing a thumb across the neck, I'm like, I'm sorry, I know I just said the wrong thing. And then I try to back it up with, that's just my opinion. And your opinion is really what matters here, not mine.
What guidance would you give to leaders today?
Yeah, like looking to yourself like 4 years ago when you started this position, you said like, I didn't know, I didn't have like the training, I didn't think I have like the background.
One final note for our listeners, what would you say to them?
I'll tell you what has changed dramatically from the fall of 2020 to today, and that would be, brace for it, self-awareness. I have been in nonprofit leadership for a long time, but when you are doing human services, your personal self-awareness is probably the most valuable thing you can bring to the table as a leader. If you don't know how others see you and you don't know how your opinions or your tone of voice or your face is being read by the people you're serving, as well as your colleagues, start there. I definitely don't think it's something anyone could ever nail, but I do think it's always a work in progress, and it's so important to be working on that pretty much at all times if you're gonna try to do a leadership role in a nonprofit organization. The guidance I would give anybody entering nonprofit leadership, specifically in human services, would be to look for your resources. Look all around you for the people in the community who know more than you, who've been doing it longer than you. And I could just give some shout outs. I mean, right away I had different people, you know, would you meet me for lunch? Could I just pick your brain? Tell me how this industry works. What do I need to know? And the more people I met with, the more I learned, the more I realized that actually the warm handoff, in addition to all the information they're giving, the warm handoff in human services is worth its weight in gold. In our community, because we're small, when someone's in crisis and I think I know a resource they could really utilize, if I can make a phone call and say, you know, hey, Jim, I'm sitting here with a young lady who really needs blank. Do you have any extra? And he says, yeah, of course. You want me to just drop it off? And I say, yes. Could we have time tomorrow? No, I'll bring it right now. You know, that kind of power to utilize resources is amazing, and then be that resource. Mm-hmm. And so now, 4 years later, Seton House can be that resource for so many other organizations. You know, I write grants for all kinds of things, thinking, do we really need this? Maybe we don't, but someone I know does. So we need, you know, 20 of these coats, and they're gonna bring me 200, and I'm gonna find 180 other people who need the coats that I just wrote a grant for. Because really, big picture, I mean, absolutely every resource that we get, if we can share it with the other organizations, we're helping all the same people.
Yes.
The people we're serving are the most vulnerable people in this community, and the more people helping, the better.
What a great way to end it. Carrie, it was such a pleasure speaking with you today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was really nice to meet you. Yeah.